Master.
R2 trying to increase the power.
Yahoo!
You're all clear, kid.
Hi friends, Vic Sage here, and thank you for taking the time to listen to a new episode of the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. Before we begin, I want to apologize about having to skip the month of January. The truth of the matter is, my day job has become a little more time-consuming than it was in the past. Returning home, I basically want to eat dinner and go to bed. Having said that, however, I had intended to produce a one-up episode just so there was something new for you all to enjoy. But at the last second, work once again threw a monkey wrench into the plans, and the opportunity just slipped away. So, with that out of the way, let us begin our first episode of 2020, a classic sci-fi maze shooter that not only featured speech, but was released 39 years ago. I am, of course, talking about Midway's Wizard of War. Wizard of War was not a game I first encountered at the Showbiz Pizza of my youth, but at Games People Play, which I have discussed on the show before, and in greater detail with the last episode on the classic 1980 title Star Castle. Much like with Berserk, in my youth, I was always a sucker for an arcade game that had the ability to talk. Off the top of my head, titles like Gorf, Astro Blaster, Star Wars, and of course, Sinistar were some of my favorites. Hearing digitized speech coming from a game while wandering through the arcade would draw me to it like a magnet. There was just something so utterly magical about the illusion of a game in a busy arcade speaking just to you.
Remember, I'm a wizard, not you.
In particular, I can remember when I first stepped up to the arcade cabinet. I was really impressed with the beauty of the marquee, featuring what I would come to learn was a player's warrior, clad in what appeared to be yellow armor, with a dual oxygen tank strapped to his back, sporting a space helmet with a blackened visor. The warrior has a futuristic rifle raised as he's facing a gathering of alien beasts, also yellow-hued, that await him to step into the wizard's deadly maze. In fact, the wizard himself looms large in blue and gray on the right-hand side of the marquee, clawed hands raised high and conjuring up the game's title in eye-catching yellow and red. I also couldn't help but notice that War, in this case, was spelled W-O-R. Watching the attract screen, which introduced the characters in the game, I realized that all A's were removed. So, Warrior was spelled W-O-R-R-I-O-R. While soaking all of this in, I just happened to touch the joystick and was rewarded with a message from the wizard. Which I did immediately, and as I recall, looking back on that first game, I did okay. But soon, I was reaching into my jean pockets for another quarter to feed into the Wizard of War. While I was most certainly a fan of video games, even at an early age, Wizard of War was special, and it hooked its digital claws into me. I mentioned a moment ago that Wizard of War was published by Midway, who by 1981 had already found success as a game publisher thanks to a license with Taito, releasing a little 1978 game called Space Invaders here in the States, and finding itself with an even bigger hit on its hand when, 2 years later, it released Namco's Pac-Man. In addition, Midway had done well for themselves in 1979 by publishing another Namco title, Galaxian. And then, of course, in 81, they released Galaga. Wizard of War, though, was developed by Dave Nutting Associates, a kind of important name in arcade game history to say the least. You see, 1971's Computer Space, which was designed by Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney, who at that time had founded Syzygy Engineering, and who would go on to co-found Atari, was published by Nutting Associates, which was a company that was founded by Bill Nutting, who happened to be Dave's brother. Dave Nutting actually started his professional career as a design engineer at Brooks Stevens Associates, This was after he left the Army Corps of Engineers. At BSA, he would have a hand in working on everything from the Jeep Grand Wagoneer, the Instrom helicopter, and vehicles for Studebaker, to name a few projects. Thanks to an article I read on the Golden Age Arcade Historian blog, I found out that David left BSA in 1967 to go and work for his brother, saying in an interview, quote, "By profession, I'm an industrial designer. I kind of backed into the coin-op business when my brother came and said he had an idea to take a teaching machine and put a coin slot on it. I completely re-engineered and redesigned it. He then built his version, Computer Quiz, in California, and I built mine, IQ Computer, in Milwaukee. He built about 4,000, and I built about 3,500. So, between the two of us, we made about 8,000. In those days, those were big, big numbers. One of the big reasons for its success was that it was a location finder. In other words, a lot of locations objected to putting pinballs in and so on, but they couldn't object to putting an educational type machine in. A lot of operators used it to get into locations, and that's why it was so successful." End quote. It's a really great article, and while I believe the Golden Age Arcade Historian blog stopped being updated in 2016, it has some amazing information on the Golden Age of arcade games. As always, I will be sure to include a link to the Golden Age Arcade Historian blog on this article post for the podcast. Anyway, it was in 1971 that Bill dropped out of the game, so to speak, and Dave would end up forming Dave Nutting Associates, along with engineer Jeff Fredrickson. This was after a brief stint as MCI, short for Milwaukee Coin Industries, producing electromechanical games like 1975's U-Boat, or projection screen titles like 1972's Red Baron and Desert Fox. You know, an image would be projected and the player would shoot at said image. At Dave Nutting Associates, the duo ended up producing the first microprocessor pinball design for Bally's 1975 Flicker pinball table. And then, after hiring Jamie Fenton, as well as Tom McHugh, who were apparently attending the University of Wisconsin at the time, Dave had them focus on video game software, and they ended up stepping firmly into video game design with 1975's Gunfight for Midway. Other notable titles that they developed include 1976 Seawolf and its sequel in 1978, Gorf, and even 1982's Baby Pac-Man. It was Dave Nutting and Tom McHugh who are credited with designing and programming Wizard of War. Nutting would also have a hand in the likes of 1981's Gorf and The Adventures of Robbie Roto, the latter being a game I've wanted to play for quite some time, but haven't had the opportunity to as of yet. Perhaps if I ever get the chance to visit the legendary Galloping Ghost Arcade in Brookfield, Illinois, I can remedy that situation. Tom McHugh also worked on Gunfight, in addition to the two Seawolf games, before working on games for both the Bally Astrocade and even the ColecoVision. I've read online that after the video game crash of 83, McHugh left the video game business entirely. Now then, Wizard of War tasks 1-2 players, competitively or cooperatively, which was a novel approach in 1981. Although, I believe in regard to co-op titles, it was Atari's 1978 Fire Truck that lays claim to being the first to offer co-op play in a video game. And even with that co-op option in Wizard of War, if a player isn't careful, a stray shot might take out their fellow warrior braving the deadly dungeon maze of the wizard. Which in more than a few times playing it at games people play back in the day, the game would devolve into momentarily forgetting about the enemies and just blasting away at your fellow player, whether out of revenge or just being a jerk. The players using a four-way joystick, allowing movement up and down, as well as left and right, controls their warrior as they try to survive as long as possible against the growing number of monsters that the wizard sends your way. Player 1 is represented by the yellow-hued warrior, starting off in the bottom right-hand side of the screen, with the second player being tinted blue and beginning in the left-hand side of the dungeon. If there's just one player, the game will take over control of the blue warrior. It is worth noting that just by tapping the joystick in a desired direction, the warrior can face in said direction without actually moving. Quite useful when the wizard's minions are coming at you from two directions in later stages, also known as dungeons. Thanks to the fire button, a player can fire off an energized shot from their futuristic rifle in the direction they are currently facing. but it bears remembering that only one shot from a player can be on the screen at any given time. If it makes contact with a wall of the maze, or of course one of the monsters, the player can fire again. You can already see how this might be a problem in later dungeons, when the creatures are moving pretty fast. Say, you fire off a shot down a hallway in the maze, which means you have no way to defend yourself if a monster comes in close to you. If you are hit by either a player's shot or make contact with an enemy or are struck by one of their shots, you will lose a life. I should add that after losing a life or upon entering a new dungeon stage, players will appear in a little alcove at the bottom of the screen, just above the score. A player will have 10 seconds to remain in that area before forcibly being ejected out, and usually at the most inopportune time to boot. This feature was added so if an area was currently being patrolled by a monster, the player can time their entrance to increase their chance at survival, especially in later dungeon stages. Now, there is also an exit of sorts represented by two doorways, situated a little above the middle of the screen, with arrows pointing to the right and left. Entering from the left-hand door, a player will walk through the right side door. It's a wraparound effect. However, not only can monsters use doors, but after it's been activated, it will become locked for a few seconds. Nothing worse than trying to take out the monsters in front of you and a quick-moving enemy appears behind you and wipes you out. When the fleet and deadly warlock or wizard decide to appear in the maze, the doors will immediately reopen. Also of benefit to the players is a small rectangular radar in the middle of the bottom of the screen, sandwiched in between the scores for the yellow and blue warriors. It's not a detailed map. It won't display the maze walls, or the warriors, or even the crafty wizard. His magic is too strong for your pitiful technology. But it does allow for a player to glance down and see the relative locations of the monsters. Particularly useful when the wizard's minions decide to start stalking you after they've become invisible.
If you destroy my baby, I'll pop you in the oven.
Wow! The mouth on the Wizard of War. Sheesh! The radar will also provide information, such as what dungeon you happen to be in addition to the rival of the Warlock or the Wizard of War, and even if you've earned double score for the next dungeon stage. I suppose it is time to talk about the various enemies a player will face off against in Wizard of War. First up is the Burwar, a blue-colored bipedal wolf-looking enemy. The Burwars obviously start off quite slow, but in later levels, they rush around the maze almost aimlessly. It kind of looks like they're moving in packs. As almost all the foes in the game, they can shoot an energy blast at the player, but thankfully are unable to render themselves invisible. While every dungeon stage will begin with six of these beasts, in the first dungeon level, after a warrior has dispatched the Burwars, a single yellow-colored Garwar will show up. Blasting that foe will result in a Thorwar arriving. By the time a player has reached the sixth dungeon stage, every time a Burwar is defeated, a Garwar will arrive in the maze to seek out the player. For what it might be worth, there can only be up to six monsters on screen at any given time. I've also read online that for every 7 seconds that pass in the game, the monsters will increase their speed. Much like with Space Invaders, the steady thrum sound that fills the dungeon begins to speed up as you whittle down the monsters in the mazes. The Garwar is sort of a yellow-hued dinosaur, and is definitely more deadly as it can turn invisible while wandering the stage. However, if a warrior is in the same section of the maze, whether the corridor is traveling up or down, or left or right, the Garwar will become visible again. This isn't always that helpful, as they can really book it in later stages. When a warrior manages to shoot a Garwar, a very dangerous Thorwar will come into the maze. The Thorwar is a red-colored, six-legged and horned centipede-looking beastie. These foes are able to become invisible too, and do a far better job of hunting down the warriors than the other creatures. Starting in the second dungeon level, once players have blasted the last Thorwar, the Warlock will arrive. The This speedy and erratic monster that resembles a sort of yellow and blue colored bee may not be able to shoot at the player or become invisible, but its flight through the mazes of a dungeon make it incredibly dangerous nonetheless. It also has only one goal, making it through one of the exit doors. If the players manage to defeat it, for their efforts on the next dungeon, all the points are doubled for that stage. If the warlock gets past the warriors and escapes out one of the doors, there is no penalty beyond losing that opportunity to score big points. That doubled bonus is also true for when the wizard decides to take matters into his own hands, teleporting in at times after a player has defeated the warlock. The blue-cloaked wizard of war is truly a deadly foe, teleporting over and over again, seeming to hone in on a player, showing up for just a second, slinging a lightning bolt before disappearing again. If a warrior is lucky enough to land a shot on this ultimate enemy, the screen freezes and turns black and white, as it sort of sounds like the game is malfunctioning. This is to demonstrate the wizard's displeasure at having been temporarily bested, before starting up again with the next dungeon level. Now, if the Wizard of War manages to take out a player, the next dungeon stage will commence, usually followed with the heckling laugh by the wizard for his accomplishment. I have not found anything online that exactly explains what triggers the arrival of the Wizard of War, although I have read that it might have to do with what level of the dungeon you are currently on, as well as how many extra lives have been attained by the players. There are two special dungeons that players will find themselves in throughout the game. The first is reached in dungeon level 4, and is known as the Arena, which offers up a kind of dangerously open area in the middle with tapered maze walls close to the exit doors on the right and left-hand side of the screens. There is ample space for the monsters of the wizard to move out of the way to avoid your shots, but it's a cakewalk compared to when you reach dungeon stage 13, the Pit. Which is a good description of what it is like to try to survive for this level. There are no maze walls or corridors for a player's shot to hit, so you have to be sure that each shot is going to take out a foe. Plus, without the corridors of the maze, the beasties are running rampant anywhere they want. If players are able to survive the pit, which they will descend into every sixth stage after dungeon stage 13, if they've not lost a single life in the pit, they will earn the title of Warlord Supreme. And good luck with that. Actually, after the 7th dungeon level, the warriors will enter the Warlord dungeons, which present mazes with less walls and corridors, making it harder for players to try and corral the foes. There is a pretty nice trick in Wizard of War. Players can pass through each other. So if you pass just enough that each player is covering a single direction, in effect, standing back to back, you can have a better chance at defending a section of the maze from the monsters. Now, it should be noted that the monsters can do this too. In fact, after blasting a monster, it explodes. While that explosion is on the screen, it will actually block a new shot from either a monster or a player attempting to fry a creature that is coming through said explosion. So, when things get crowded with the monsters, it can get pretty intense. Before entering the pit or arena, players will receive an extra life. A gift from the wizard, I suppose, for doing so well. In total, you can have 16 extra lives. Let's talk a bit about the scores. Blasting a Burwar gets you 100 points. Gur Wars are worth 200 points. Thor Wars net you 500 points. Warlocks are 1,000 points, as is your fellow warrior. And the Wizard of War will get you 2,500 points for landing a shot on him and momentarily chasing him away. To add to the impressive gameplay of Wizard of War, we have to take a moment and point to the fact that the game has 71 lines of speech, although there are times when it is very hard to understand what is being said. I'm not going to remotely go over all of them, but some of my favorites include Burwar hasn't eaten anyone in months, ha 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 ha. Garwar and Thorwar become invisible, ha ha ha. Your explosion was music to my ears, ha ha ha. That is naturally when you are struck down by the wizard himself. In the pit, he can say, Warlord, where are you going to hide now? And at the end of the game, players might be lucky enough to hear, The Wizard of War thanks you. It appears that the high score holder for Wizard of War for single player is Doug Lowry, an achievement accomplished on July 17th of 2008. The high score holder for two players is John Thomas and Josh Powell, with 1,300,300 points, and was verified by referee on June 2nd of 2002. At the Arcadia Retrocade, I'm not sure who is the single-player high score holder, probably John Munkus, Henry Holder, or possibly Michael Dietrich, but I can tell you that I was part of the team that earned the two-player high score, along with a fellow Arcadian, and we amassed 130,000 points. We were on fire that night.
And now, these messages.
If you took one of America's leading video games and added three built-in games, four-player capability, a three-octave music synthesizer, 256 color variations, a built-in calculator, and a basic program making it a personal home computer, you'd have Astrocade, the professional arcade. With a never-ending library of coin-op quality exciting games.
I'm John Madden for CBS Video Games. I've got a great money-back offer for you. But first, watch this exciting competition in the CBS Video Games Challenge of Champions. Today's challengers, Arcade Aces, Tony Sarkis against Ray Johnson. The game, Wizard of War, new from CBS Video Games. The object, defeat the wizard, his henchmen, and your opponent.
Tony hits Warlock. He misses Ray. Ray fires at the wizard. Wizard zap Tony.
Ray Johnson wins. Wizard of War, new from CBS Video Games.
Are you up to the challenge?
You've seen how challenging Wizard of War is. Now we'll bet your money back that Wizard is tougher than you are. Buy it, and after 3 days, if you think otherwise, return it to your participating dealer with your receipt and get your money back. How can we make this money back offer? Because we know how tough this game is. But maybe you're not up to the challenge.
Wizard of War did okay back in the golden age of the arcade, managing to be ported to the popular home consoles of the day, such as the Atari 2600, a really nice port as well, courtesy of CBS Electronics, who also produced a version for the Atari 5200. Rockland Software was responsible for the Atari home computer's version, with Commodore producing a version for the C64, considered to be one of the best ports, in fact. A version of Wizard of War was produced for the Bally Astrocade, which shouldn't be surprising, I suppose. But what is strange is they didn't call it Wizard of War, instead entitling the game The Incredible Wizard. I can only assume that there was some licensing deal they made with either CBS Electronics or Commodore that stipulated they couldn't name it Wizard of War. I'm just spitballing here. I can find no concrete proof online for why it was called The Incredible Wizard. It's a pretty nice looking port though, at least I can tell you that. Wizard of War was one of the first 50 games that Shay Mathis obtained before opening the Arcadia Retrocade. For over 7 years, the wizard has been taunting players who happen to step up and challenge him in his deadly maze. Surprisingly enough, it actually isn't that popular at the arcade, although I can assure you that I played a couple times a week. It might be straightforward in regards to how you play the game, but Wizard of War is still tough, and one of my favorites. And friends, I think that about wraps up our episode. As always, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen to the show, and I really do appreciate your support, especially in this case, in the understanding of the tardiness of this particular episode. I'm no expert, just a fan of classic arcade and home console games, and enjoy talking about them. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is currently available on iTunes. I'm working on rebuilding the podcast library, slowly, a result of switching from the Retroist site to the Pop Culture Retrorama one, which you can check out daily posts by visiting www.popculturetrorama.com. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is now available on Google Podcasts, as well as Spotify. No matter how you listen to the show, if you have a moment and enjoy the podcast, why not give us a rating and a review to help us find new listeners? You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or for daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. You can also find me posting videos of the arcade or photographs on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. Of course, I want to thank The Retroist. For over a decade, The Retroist provided a spot on the internet where fans of all things retro could visit and enjoy the best retro-related articles and podcasts. I certainly wouldn't have my own site or multiple podcasts without The Retroist's support. And I'm happy to say, after a brief hiatus, The Retroist has started posting on his website once again. He's even working on new podcasts. So, make sure to check him out. I am planning on a one-up episode later this month, maybe even a couple if I'm lucky. Until then, though, why not have a token on me as you listen to a clip of the game I will talk about in the next show? This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Midway, Bally Midway, Dave Nutting Associates, or any of the individuals and businesses that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from the mentioned video games are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
How can we make this money back offer? Because we know how tough this game is.
End of line.